Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Chapter 6 of Part 4 of The Idiot, Parts 3 and 4 by Fyodor Dostoevsky. Translated by Eva M. Martin. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. As to the evening party at the Epanchins, at which Princess Bielokonski was to be present, Varya had reported with accuracy, though she had perhaps expressed herself too strongly. The thing was decided in a hurry and with a certain amount of quite unnecessary excitement, doubtless because nothing could be done in this house like anywhere else. The impatience of Lizabetha Prokofievna to get things settled explained a good deal, as well as the anxiety of both parents for the happiness of their beloved daughter. Besides, Princess Bielokonski was going away soon, and they hoped that she would take an interest in the prince. They were anxious that he should enter society under the auspices of this lady, whose patronage was the best of recommendations for any young man. Even if there seems something strange about the match, the general and his wife said to each other, the world will accept Aglaya's fiancé without any question if he is under the patronage of the princess. In any case, the prince would have to be shown, sooner or later, that is, introduced into society, of which he had, so far, not the least idea. Moreover, it was only a question of a small gathering of a few intimate friends. Besides Princess Bielokonski, only one other lady was expected, the wife of a high dignitary. Evgeny Pavlovitch, who was to escort the princess, was the only young man. Muishkin was told of the princess's visit 3 days beforehand, but nothing was said to him about the party until the night before it was to take place. He could not help observing the excited and agitated condition of all members of the family, and from certain hints dropped in conversation, he gathered that they were all anxious as to the impression he should make upon the princess. But the Epanchins, one and all, believed that Muishkin, in his simplicity of mind, was quite incapable of realizing that they could be feeling any anxiety on his account, and for this reason they all looked at him with dread and uneasiness. In point of fact, he did attach marvelously little importance to the approaching event. He was occupied with altogether different thoughts. Aglaya was growing hourly more capricious and gloomy, and this distressed him. When they told him that Evgeny Pavlovitch was expected, he evinced great delight, and said that he had long wished to see him. And somehow these words did not please anyone. Aglaya left the room in a fit of irritation, and it was not until late in the evening, past 11, when the prince was taking his departure, that she said a word or two to him, privately, as she accompanied him as far as the front door. "I should like you," she said, "not to come here tomorrow until evening, when the guests are all assembled. You know there are to be guests, don't you?" She spoke impatiently and with severity. This was the first allusion she had made to the party of tomorrow. She hated the idea of it, Everyone saw that, and she would probably have liked to quarrel about it with her parents, but pride and modesty prevented her from broaching the subject. The prince jumped to the conclusion that Aglaya, too, was nervous about him, and the impression he would make, and that she did not like to admit her anxiety, and this thought alarmed him. "Yes, I am invited," he replied. She was evidently in difficulties as to how best to go on. "May I speak of something serious to you for once in my life?" she asked angrily. She was irritated at she knew not what, and could not restrain her wrath. "Of course you may. I'm very glad to listen," replied Muishkin. Aglaya was silent a moment and then began again with evident dislike of her subject. "I do not wish to quarrel with them about this. In some things they won't be reasonable. I always did feel a loathing for the laws which seem to guide Mama's conduct at times. I don't speak of father, for he cannot be expected to be anything but what he is. Mother is a noble-minded woman, I know. You try to suggest anything mean to her, and you'll see. But she is such a slave to these miserable creatures. I don't mean old Bielokonski alone. She is a contemptible old thing, but she is able to twist people round her little finger, and I admire that in her, at all events. How mean it all is, and how foolish! We were always middle-class, thoroughly middle-class people. Why should we attempt to climb into the giddy heights of the fashionable world? My sisters are all for it. It's Prince S. they have to thank for poisoning their minds. Why are you so glad that Evgeny Pavlovitch is coming?" "Listen to me, Aglaya," said the prince. "I do believe you are nervous lest I shall make a fool of myself tomorrow at your party." "Nervous about you?" Aglaya blushed. "Why should I be nervous about you? What should it matter to me if you were to make ever such a fool of yourself? How can you say such a thing? What do you mean by making a fool of yourself? What a vulgar expression! I suppose you intend to talk in that sort of way tomorrow evening. Look up a few more such expressions in your dictionary. Do, you'll make a grand effect. I'm sorry that you seem to be able to come into a room as gracefully as you do. Where did you learn the art? Do you think you can drink a cup of tea decently when you know everybody is looking at you, on purpose to see how you do it?" "Yes, I think I can." "Can you? I'm sorry for it, then, for I should have had a good laugh at you otherwise. Do break something, at least, in the drawing-room. Upset the Chinese vase, won't you? It's a valuable one. Do break it. Mama values it, and she'll go out of her mind. It was a present. She'll cry before everyone, you'll see. Wave your hand about, you know, as you always do, and just smash it. Sit down near it on purpose." "On the contrary, I shall sit as far from it as I can. Thanks for the hint." "Ha ha! Then you are afraid you will wave your arms about. I wouldn't mind betting that you'll talk about some lofty subject, something serious and learned. How delightful, how tactful that will be!" "I should think it would be very foolish indeed, unless it happened to come in appropriately." "Look here, once for all," cried Aglaya, boiling over. "If I hear you talking about capital punishment, or the economical condition of Russia, or about beauty redeeming the world, or anything of that sort, well, of course I shall laugh and seem very pleased, but I warn you beforehand, don't look me in the face again. I'm serious now, mind, this time, I am really serious." She certainly did say this very seriously, so much so that she looked quite different from what she usually was, and the prince could not help noticing the fact. She did not seem to be joking in the slightest degree. "Well, you've put me into such a fright that I shall certainly make a fool of myself, and very likely break something, too. I wasn't a bit alarmed before, but now I'm as nervous as can be." "Then don't speak at all. Sit still and don't talk." "Oh, I can't do that, you know. I shall say something foolish out of pure funk, and break something for the same excellent reason. I know I shall. Perhaps I shall slip and fall on the slippery floor. I've done that before now, you know. I shall dream of it all night now. Why did you say anything about it?" Aglaya looked blackly at him. "Do you know what? I had better not come at all tomorrow. I'll plead sick list and stay away," said the prince, with decision. Aglaya stamped her foot and grew quite pale with anger. "Oh, my goodness! Just listen to that! better not come, when the party is on purpose for him. Good Lord, what a delightful thing it is to have to do with such a stupid as you are!" "Well, I'll come," interrupted the prince hastily, "and I'll give you my word of honour that I will sit the whole evening and not say a word." "I believe that's the best thing you can do. You said you'd plead sick list just now. Where in the world do you get hold of such expressions? Why do you talk to me like this? Are you trying to irritate me or what?" "Forgive me, it's a schoolboy expression. I won't do it again. I know quite well, I see it, that you are anxious on my account. Now don't be angry. And it makes me very happy to see it. You wouldn't believe how frightened I am of misbehaving somehow, and how glad I am of your instructions. But all this panic is simply nonsense, you know, Aglaya. I give you my word, it is. I am so pleased that you are such a child, such a dear good child. How charming you can be if you like, Aglaya." Aglaya wanted to be angry, of course, but suddenly some quite unexpected feeling seized upon her heart, all in a moment. "And you won't reproach me for all these rude words of mine, some day, afterwards?" she asked, of a sudden. "What an idea! Of course not! And what are you blushing for again? And there comes that frown once more. You've taken to looking too gloomy sometimes, Aglaya, much more than you used to. I know why it is." "Be quiet! Do be quiet!" No, I had much better speak out. I have long wished to say it, and have said it, but that's not enough, for you didn't believe me. Between us two there stands a being who—" "Be quiet! Be quiet! Be quiet! Be quiet!" Aglaya struck in, suddenly, seizing his hand in hers and gazing at him almost in terror. At this moment she was called by someone. She broke loose from him with an air of relief and ran away. The prince was in a fever all night. It was strange, but he had suffered from fever for several nights in succession. On this particular night, while in semi-delirium, he had an idea. What if on the morrow he were to have a fit before everybody? The thought seemed to freeze his blood within him. All night he fancied himself in some extraordinary society of strange persons. The worst of it was that he was talking nonsense. He knew that he ought not to speak at all, and yet he talked the whole time. He seemed to be trying to persuade them all to something. Evgenie and Hippolyte were among the guests, and appeared to be great friends. He awoke towards 9 o'clock with a headache, full of confused ideas and strange impressions. For some reason or other he felt most anxious to see Rogojin, to see and talk to him, but what he wished to say he could not tell. Next he determined to go and see Hippolyte. His mind was in a confused state, so much so that the incidents of the morning seemed to be imperfectly realized, though acutely felt. One of these incidents was a visit from Lebedev. Lebedev came rather early, before 10, but he was tipsy already. Though the prince was not in an observant condition, yet he could not avoid seeing that for at least 3 days, ever since General Ivolgin had left the house, Lebedev had been behaving very badly. He looked untidy and dirty at all times of the day, and it was said that he had begun to rage about in his own house, and that his temper was very bad. As soon as he arrived this morning, he began to hold forth, beating his breast and apparently blaming himself for something.
I've had a reward for my meanness. I've had a slap in the face," he concluded tragically.
"A slap in the face? From whom? And so early in the morning?"
"Early," said Lebedev, sarcastically. "Time counts for nothing, even in physical chastisement. But my slap in the face was not physical. It was moral."
He suddenly took a seat, very unceremoniously, and began his story. It was very disconnected. The prince frowned and wished he could get away. But suddenly a few words struck him. He sat stiff with wonder. Lebedev said some extraordinary things. In the first place he began about some letter. The name of Aglaya Ivanovna came in. Then suddenly he broke off and began to accuse the prince of something. He was apparently offended with him. At first he declared that the prince had trusted him with his confidences as to a certain person, Nastasia Philipovna, but that of late his friendship had been thrust back into his bosom, and his innocent question, as to approaching family changes, had been curtly put aside, which Lebedev declared, with tipsy tears,
he could not bear, especially as he knew so much already both from Rogojin and Nastasia Philipovna and her friend, and from Varvara Darlianovna, and even from Aglaya Ivanovna, through his daughter Vera. And who told Lizabetha Prokofievna something in secret, by letter? Who told her all about the movements of a certain person called Nastasia Philipovna? Who was the anonymous person, eh? Tell me.
Surely not you, cried the prince.
Just so, said Lebedev with dignity. And only this very morning I have sent up a letter to the noble lady, stating that I have a matter of great importance to communicate. She received the letter, I know she got it, and she received me too.
Have you just seen Lizabetha Prokofievna? Asked the prince, scarcely believing his ears.
Yes, I saw her, and got the said slap in the face as mentioned. She chucked the letter back to me unopened, and kicked me out of the house, morally, not physically, although not far off it.
What letter do you mean she returned unopened?
What, didn't I tell you? Ha ha ha! I thought I had. Why, I received a letter, you know, to be handed over.
From whom? To whom?
But it was difficult, if not impossible, to extract anything from Lebedev. All the prince could gather was that the letter had been received very early, and had a request written on the outside that it might be sent on to the address given.
Just as before, sir, just as before. To a certain person, and from a certain hand. The individual's name who wrote the letter is to be represented by the letter A.
What? Impossible! To Nastasia Philipovna? Nonsense! Cried the prince.
It was, I assure you, and if not to her, then to Rogojin, which is the same thing. Mr. Hippolyte has had letters too, and all from the individual whose name begins with an A, smirked Lebedev with a hideous grin. As he kept jumping from subject to subject, and forgetting what he had begun to talk about, the prince said nothing, but waited to give him time. It was all very vague. Who had taken the letters, if letters there were? Probably Vera. And how could Lebedev have got them? In all probability, he had managed to steal the present letter from Vera, and had himself gone over to Lizabetha Prokofievna with some idea in his head. So the prince concluded at last.
"You are mad!" he cried, indignantly.
"Not quite, esteemed prince," replied Lebedev, with some acerbity. "I confess I thought of doing you the service of handing the letter over to yourself, but I decided that it would pay me better to deliver it up to the noble lady aforesaid, as I had informed her of everything hitherto by anonymous letters. So when I sent her up a note from myself, with the letter, you know, in order to fix a meeting for 8 o'clock this morning, I signed it, 'Your secret correspondent.' They let me in at once, very quickly, by the back door, and the noble lady received me."
"Well, go on."
"Oh, well, when I saw her, she almost punched my head, as I say. In fact, so nearly that one might almost say she did punch my head. She threw the letter in my face. She seemed to reflect first, as if she would have liked to keep it, but thought better of it, and threw it in my face instead. 'If anybody can have been such a fool as to trust a man like you to deliver the letter,' says she, 'take it and deliver it.' Hey, she was grandly indignant. A fierce, fiery lady, that, sir."
"Where's the letter now?"
"Oh, I've still got it. Here."
And he handed the prince the very letter from Aglaya to Gania, which the latter showed with so much triumph to his sister at a later hour. "This letter cannot be allowed to remain in your hands."
"It's for you, for you. I've brought it to you on purpose," cried Lebedev excitedly. "Why, I'm yours again now, heart and hand, your slave. There was but a momentary pause in the flow of my love and esteem for you. Mea culpa, as the Pope of Rome says."
"This letter should be sent on at once," said the prince, disturbed. "I'll hand it over myself."
"Wouldn't it be better, esteemed prince, wouldn't it be better to, don't you know?"
Lebedev made a strange and very expressive grimace. He twisted about in his chair, and did something, apparently symbolical, with his hands.
"What do you mean?" said the prince. "Why, open it for the time being, don't you know?" he said, most confidentially and mysteriously.
The prince jumped up so furiously that Lebedev ran towards the door. Having gained which strategic position, however, he stopped and looked back to see if he might hope for pardon. "Oh, Lebedev, Lebedev, can a man really sink to such depths of meanness?" said the prince, sadly. Lebedev's face brightened. "Oh, I'm a mean wretch," he said, approaching the prince once more, and beating his breast, with tears in his eyes. "It's abominable dishonesty, you know."
"Dishonesty, it is, that's the very word."
"What in the world induces you to act so? You are nothing but a spy. Why did you write anonymously to worry so noble and generous a lady? Why should not Aglaya Ivanovna write a note to whomever she pleases? What did you mean to complain of today? What did you expect to get by it? What made you go at all?"
"Pure, amiable curiosity, I assure you. Desire to do a service, that's all. Now I'm entirely yours again, your slave. Hang me if you like."
"Did you go before Lizabetha Prokofievna in your present condition?" inquired the prince.
"No, oh no, fresher. More the correct card.
I only became this like after the humiliation I suffered there." "Well, that'll do. Now leave me." This injunction had to be repeated several times before the man could be persuaded to move. Even then he turned back at the door, came as far as the middle of the room, and there went through his mysterious motions designed to convey the suggestion that the prince should open the letter. He did not dare put his suggestion into words again. After this performance, he smiled sweetly and left the room on tiptoe. All this had been very painful to listen to. One fact stood out certain and clear, and that was that poor Aglaya must be in a state of great distress and indecision and mental torment. "From jealousy," the prince whispered to himself. Undoubtedly, in this inexperienced but hot and proud little head, there were all sorts of plans forming, wild and impossible plans, maybe, and the idea of this so frightened the prince that he could not make up his mind what to do. Something must be done, that was clear. He looked at the address on the letter once more. Oh, he was not in the least degree alarmed about Aglaya writing such a letter. He could trust her. What he did not like about it was that he could not trust Gania. However, he made up his mind that he would himself take the note and deliver it. Indeed, he went so far as to leave the house and walk up the road, but changed his mind when he had nearly reached Ptitsin's door. However, he there luckily met Kolya and commissioned him to deliver the letter to his brother, as if direct from Aglaya. Kolya asked no questions but simply delivered it, and Gania consequently had no suspicion that it had passed through so many hands. Arrived home again, the prince sent for Vera Lebedev and told her as much as was necessary in order to relieve her mind, for she had been in a dreadful state of anxiety since she had missed the letter. She heard with horror that her father had taken it. Muishkin learned from her that she had on several occasions performed secret missions both for Aglaya and for Rogojin, without, however, having had the slightest idea that in so doing she might injure the prince in any way. The latter, with one thing and another, was now so disturbed and confused that when, a couple of hours or so later, a message came from Kolya that the general was ill, he could hardly take the news in. However, when he did master the fact, it acted upon him as a tonic by completely distracting his attention. He went at once to Nina Alexandrovna's, whither the general had been carried, and stayed there until the evening. He could do no good, but there are people whom to have near one is a blessing at such times. Kolya was in an almost hysterical state. He cried continuously, but was running about all day, all the same, fetching doctors, of whom he collected three, going to the chemist's, and so on. The general was brought round to some extent, but the doctors declared that he could not be said to be out of danger. Varya and Nina Alexandrovna never left the sick man's bedside. Gania was excited and distressed, but would not go upstairs, and seemed afraid to look at the patient. He wrung his hands when the prince spoke to him, and said that such a misfortune at such a moment was terrible. The prince thought he knew what Gania meant by such a moment. Hippolyte was not in the house. Lebedev turned up late in the afternoon. He had been asleep ever since his interview with the prince in the morning. He was quite sober now, and cried with real sincerity over the sick general, mourning for him as though he were his own brother.
He blamed himself aloud, but did not explain why. He repeated over and over again to Nina Alexandrovna that he alone was to blame, no one else, but that he had acted out of pure, amiable curiosity, and that the deceased, as he insisted upon calling the still-living general, had been the greatest of geniuses. He laid much stress on the genius of the sufferer, as if this idea must be one of immense solace in the present crisis. Nina Alexandrovna, seeing his sincerity of feeling, said at last, and without the faintest suspicion of reproach in her voice, "Come, come, don't cry. God will forgive you." Lebedev was so impressed by these words and the tone in which they were spoken that he could not leave Nina Alexandrovna all the evening, in fact, for several days. Till the general's death, indeed, he spent almost all his time at his side. Twice during the day, a messenger came to Nina Alexandrovna from the Epanchins to inquire after the invalid. When, late in the evening, the prince made his appearance in Lizabetha Prokofievna's drawing-room, he found it full of guests. Mrs. Epanchin questioned him very fully about the general as soon as he appeared, and when old Princess Bielokonski wished to know who this general was and who was Nina Alexandrovna, she proceeded to explain in a manner which pleased the prince very much. He himself, when relating the circumstances of the general's illness to Lizabetha Prokofievna, spoke beautifully, as Aglaya's sisters declared afterwards, modestly, quietly, without gestures or too many words, and with great dignity. He had entered the room with propriety and grace, and he was perfectly dressed. He not only did not fall down on the slippery floor, as he had expressed it, but evidently made a very favourable impression upon the assembled guests. As for his own impression on entering the room and taking his seat, he instantly remarked that the company was not in the least such as Aglaya's words had led him to fear, and as he had dreamed of, in nightmare form, all night. This was the first time in his life that he had seen a little corner of what was generally known by the terrible name of society. He had long thirsted, for reasons of his own, to penetrate the mysteries of the magic circle, and, therefore, this assemblage was of the greatest possible interest to him. His first impression was one of fascination. Somehow or other he felt that all these people must have been born on purpose to be together. It seemed to him that the Epanchins were not having a party at all, that these people must have been here always, and that he himself was one of them, returned among them after a long absence, but one of them, naturally and indisputably. It never struck him that all this refined simplicity and nobility and wit and personal dignity might possibly be no more than an exquisite artistic polish. The majority of the guests, who were somewhat empty-headed after all, in spite of their aristocratic bearing, never guessed, in their self-satisfied composure, that much of their superiority was mere veneer, which indeed they had adopted unconsciously and by inheritance. The prince would never so much as suspect such a thing in the delight of his first impression. He saw, for instance, that one important dignitary, old enough to be his grandfather, broke off his own conversation in order to listen to him, a young and inexperienced man, and not only listened, but seemed to attach value to his opinion, and was kind and amiable, and yet they were strangers and had never seen each other before. Perhaps what most appealed to the prince's impressionability was the refinement of the old man's courtesy towards him. Perhaps the soil of his susceptible nature was really predisposed to receive a pleasant impression. Meanwhile, all these people, though friends of the family and of each other to a certain extent, were very far from being such intimate friends of the family and of each other as the prince concluded. There were some present who never would think of considering the Epanchins their equals. There were even some who hated one another cordially. For instance, old Princess Bielokonski had all her life despised the wife of the dignitary, while the latter was very far from loving Lizabetha Prokofievna. The dignitary himself had been General Epanchin's protector from his youth up, and the general considered him so majestic a personage that he would have felt a hearty contempt for himself if he had even for one moment allowed himself to pose as the great man's equal, or to think of him, in his fear and reverence, as anything less than an Olympic god. There were others present who had not met for years, and who had no feeling whatever for each other, unless it were dislike. And yet they met tonight as though they had seen each other but yesterday, in some friendly and intimate assembly of kindred spirits. It was not a large party, however. Besides Princess Bielokonski and the old dignitary, who was really a great man, and his wife, there was an old military general, a count or baron with a German name, a man reputed to possess great knowledge and administrative ability. He was one of those Olympian administrators who know everything except Russia, pronounce a word of extraordinary wisdom admired by all about once in 5 years, and after being an eternity in the service, generally die full of honor and riches, though they have never done anything great, and have even been hostile to all greatness. This general was Ivan Fedorovitch's immediate superior in the service, and it pleased the latter to look upon him also as a patron. On the other hand, the great man did not at all consider himself Epanchin's patron. He was always very cool to him while taking advantage of his ready services, and would instantly have put another in his place if there had been the slightest reason for the change. Another guest was an elderly, important-looking gentleman, a distant relative of Lizabetha Prokofievna's. This gentleman was rich, held a good position, was a great talker, and had the reputation of being one of the dissatisfied, though not belonging to the dangerous sections of that class. He had the manners, to some extent, of the English aristocracy, and some of their tastes, especially in the matter of underdone roast beef, harness, men-servants, etc. He was a great friend of the dignitaries, and Lizabetha Prokofievna, for some reason or other, had got hold of the idea that this worthy intended at no distant date to offer the advantages of his hand and heart to Alexandra. Besides the elevated and more solid individuals enumerated, there were present a few younger though not less elegant guests. Besides Prince S. and Evgeny Pavlovitch, we must name the eminent and fascinating Prince N., once the vanquisher of female hearts all over Europe. This gentleman was no longer in the first bloom of youth. He was 45, but still very handsome. He was well off, and lived, as a rule, abroad, and was noted as a good teller of stories. Then came a few guests belonging to a lower stratum of society, people who, like the Epanchins themselves, moved only occasionally in this exalted sphere. The Epanchins liked to draft among their more elevated guests a few picked representatives of this lower stratum, and Lizabetha Prokofievna received much praise for this practice, which proved, her friends said, that she was a woman of tact. The Epanchins prided themselves upon the good opinion people held of them. One of the representatives of the middle class present today was a colonel of engineers, a very serious man and a great friend of Prince S., who had introduced him to the Epanchins. He was extremely silent in society, and displayed on the forefinger of his right hand a large ring, probably bestowed upon him for services of some sort. There was also a poet, German by name, but a Russian poet, very presentable and even handsome, the sort of man one could bring into society with impunity. This gentleman belonged to a German family of decidedly bourgeois origin, but he had a knack of acquiring the patronage of bigwigs, and of retaining their favor. He had translated some great German poem into Russian verse, and claimed to have been a friend of a famous Russian poet, since dead. It is strange how great a multitude of literary people there are who have had the advantages of friendship with some great man of their own profession who is, unfortunately, dead. The dignitary's wife had introduced this worthy to the Epanchins. This lady posed as the patroness of literary people, and she certainly had succeeded in obtaining pensions for a few of them, thanks to her influence with those in authority on such matters. She was a lady of weight in her own way. Her age was about 45, so that she was a very young wife for such an elderly husband as the dignitary. She had been a beauty in her day and still loved, as many ladies of 45 do love, to dress a little too smartly. Her intellect was nothing to boast of, and her literary knowledge very doubtful. Literary patronage was, however, with her as much a mania as was the love of gorgeous clothes. Many books and translations were dedicated to her by her protégés, and a few of these talented individuals had published some of their own letters to her, upon very weighty subjects. This, then, was the society that the prince accepted at once as true coin, as pure gold without alloy. It so happened, however, that on this particular evening all these good people were in excellent humour and highly pleased with themselves. Every one of them felt that they were doing the Epanchins the greatest possible honour by their presence. But alas, the prince never suspected any such subtleties. For instance, he had no suspicion of the fact that the Epanchins, having in their mind so important a step as the marriage of their daughter, would never think of presuming to take it without having previously shown off the proposed husband to the dignitary, the recognized patron of the family. The latter, too, though he would probably have received news of a great disaster to the Epanchin family with perfect composure, would nevertheless have considered it a personal offence if they had dared to marry their daughter without his advice, or we might say, his leave. The amiable and undoubtedly witty Prince N. could not but feel that he was as a sun, risen for one night only to shine upon the Epanchin drawing-room. He accounted them immeasurably his inferiors, and it was this feeling which caused his special amiability and delightful ease and grace towards them. He knew very well that he must tell some story this evening for the edification of the company, and led up to it with the inspiration of anticipatory triumph. The prince, when he heard the story afterwards, felt that he had never yet come across so wonderful a humorist, or such remarkable brilliancy as was shown by this man, and yet if he had only known it, this story was the oldest, stalest, and most worn-out yarn, and every drawing-room in town was sick to death of it. It was only in the innocent Epanchin household that it passed for a new and brilliant tale, as a sudden and striking reminiscence of a splendid and talented man. Even the German poet, though as amiable as possible, felt that he was doing the house the greatest honours by his presence in it. But the prince only looked at the bright side. He did not turn the coat and see the shabby lining. Aglaya had not foreseen that particular calamity. She herself looked wonderfully beautiful this evening. All three sisters were dressed very tastefully, and their hair was done with special care. Aglaya sat next to Evgenie Pavlovitch, and laughed and talked to him with an unusual display of friendliness. Evgenie himself behaved rather more sedately than usual, probably out of respect to the dignitary. Evgenie had been known in society for a long while. He had appeared at the Epanchins today with crepe on his hat, and Princess Bielokonski had commended this action on his part. Not every society man would have worn crepe for such an uncle. Lizabetha Prokofievna had liked it also, but was too preoccupied to take much notice. The prince remarked that Aglaya looked attentively at him two or three times, and seemed to be satisfied with his behaviour. Little by little he became very happy indeed. All his late anxieties and apprehensions, after his conversation with Lebedev, now appeared like so many bad dreams, impossible and even laughable. He did not speak much, only answering such questions as were put to him, and gradually settled down into unbroken silence, listening to what went on, and steeped in perfect satisfaction and contentment. Little by little a sort of inspiration, however, began to stir within him, ready to spring into life at the right moment. When he did begin to speak, it was accidentally, in response to a question, and apparently without any special object. End of chapter 6. Chapter 7 of Part 4 of The Idiot, Parts 3 and 4, by Fyodor Dostoevsky. Translated by Eva M. Martin. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. While he feasted his eyes upon Aglaya, as she talked merrily with Evgenie and Prince Anne, suddenly the old Anglomaniac, who was talking to the dignitary in another corner of the room, apparently telling him a story about something or other, suddenly this gentleman pronounced the name of Nikolai Andreevich Pavlichev aloud. The prince quickly turned towards him and listened. The conversation had been on the subject of land and the present disorders, and there must have been something amusing said, for the old man had begun to laugh at his companion's heated expressions. The latter was describing in eloquent words how, in consequence of recent legislation, he was obliged to sell a beautiful estate in the N province, not because he wanted ready money. In fact, he was obliged to sell it at half its value. "To avoid another lawsuit about the Pavlichev estate, I ran away," he said. "With a few more inheritances of that kind, I should soon be ruined." At this point, General Epanchin, noticing how interested Muishkin had become in the conversation, said to him, in a low tone, "That gentleman, Ivan Petrovitch, is a relation of your late friend, Mr. Pavlichev. You wanted to find some of his relations, did you not?" The general, who had been talking to his chief up to this moment, had observed the prince's solitude and silence, and was anxious to draw him into the conversation, and so introduce him again to the notice of some of the important personages.
"Lef Nikolaevitch was a ward of Nikolai Andreevich Pavlichev, after the death of his own parents," he remarked, meeting Ivan Petrovitch's eye. "Very happy to meet him, I'm sure," remarked the latter. "I remember Lef Nikolaevitch well. When General Epanchin introduced us just now, I recognized you at once, prince. You are very little changed, though I saw you last as a child of some 10 or 11 years old. There was something in your features, I suppose, that—"
"You saw me as a child!" exclaimed the prince, with surprise.
"Oh, yes, long ago," continued Ivan Petrovitch, "while you were living with my cousin at Zlatoverhof. You don't remember me?" "No, I dare say you don't. You had some malady at the time, I remember. It was so serious that I was surprised."
"No, I remember nothing," said the prince. A few more words of explanation followed, words which were spoken without the smallest excitement by his companion, but which evoked the greatest agitation in the prince, and it was discovered that two old ladies, to whose care the prince had been left by Pavlichev, and who lived in Zlatoverhof, were also relations of Ivan Petrovitch. The latter had no idea, and could give no information as to why Pavlichev had taken so great an interest in the little prince, his ward.
"In point of fact, I don't think I thought much about it," said the old fellow.
He seemed to have a wonderfully good memory, however, for he told the prince all about the two old ladies, Pavlichev's cousins, who had taken care of him, and whom, he declared, he had taken to task for being too severe with the prince as a small sickly boy. The elder sister, at least. The younger had been kind, he recollected. They both now lived in another province, on a small estate left to them by Pavlichev. The prince listened to all this with eyes sparkling with emotion and delight. He declared with unusual warmth that he would never forgive himself for having travelled about in the central provinces during these last 6 months without having hunted up his two old friends. He declared, further, that he had intended to go every day, but had always been prevented by circumstances, but that now he would promise himself the pleasure. However far it was, he would find them out. And so Ivan Petrovitch really knew Natalia Nikitishna. What a saintly nature was hers! And Martha Nikitishna! Ivan Petrovitch must excuse him, but really he was not quite fair on dear old Martha. She was severe, perhaps, but then what else could she be with such a little idiot as he was then? Ha ha! He really was an idiot then, Ivan Petrovitch must know, though he might not believe it, ha ha! So he had really seen him there! Good heavens! And was he really and truly and actually a cousin of Pavlichev's?
"I assure you of it,"
laughed Ivan Petrovitch, gazing amusedly at the prince. "Oh, I didn't say it because I doubt the fact, you know, ha ha! How could I doubt such a thing? Ha ha ha! I made the remark because Nikolai Andreevich Pavlichev was such a splendid man, don't you see? Such a high-souled man! He really was, I assure you." The prince did not exactly pant for breath, but he seemed almost to choke out of pure simplicity and goodness of heart, as Adelaida expressed it, on talking the party over with her fiancé, the Prince S., next morning.
"But my goodness me!" laughed Ivan Petrovitch. "Why can't I be a cousin to even a splendid man?"
"Oh dear!" cried the prince, confused, trying to hurry his words out, and growing more and more eager every moment. "I've gone and said another stupid thing. I don't know what to say. I...
didn't mean that, you know. He really was such a splendid man, wasn't he?"
The prince trembled all over. Why was he so agitated? Why had he flown into such transports of delight without any apparent reason? He had far outshot the measure of joy and emotion consistent with the occasion. Why this was, it would be difficult to say. He seemed to feel warmly and deeply grateful to someone for something or other, perhaps to Ivan Petrovitch, but likely enough to all the guests, individually and collectively. He was much too happy. Ivan Petrovitch began to stare at him with some surprise. The dignitary, too, looked at him with considerable attention. Princess Bielokonski glared at him angrily and compressed her lips. Prince N., Evgenie, Prince S., and the girls all broke off their own conversations and listened. Aglaya seemed a little startled. As for Lizabetha Prokofievna, her heart sank within her. This was odd of Lizabetha Prokofievna and her daughters. They had themselves decided that it would be better if the prince did not talk all the evening. Yet seeing him sitting silent and alone, but perfectly happy, they had been on the point of exerting themselves to draw him into one of the groups of talkers around the room. Now that he was in the midst of a talk, they became more than ever anxious and perturbed.
"That he was a splendid man is perfectly true. You are quite right," repeated Ivan Petrovitch, but seriously this time. "He was a fine and a worthy fellow. Worthy, one may say, of the highest respect," he added, more and more seriously at each pause. "And it is agreeable to see, on your part, such... Wasn't it this same Pavlicheff about whom there was a strange story in connection with some abbot? I don't remember who the abbot was, but I remember at one time everybody was talking about it," remarked the old dignitary.
"Yes, Abbot Gurot, a Jesuit," said Ivan Petrovitch. "Yes, that's the sort of thing our best men are apt to do. A man of rank, too, and rich. A man who, if he had continued to serve, might have done anything. And then to throw up the service and everything else in order to go over to Roman Catholicism and turn Jesuit, openly, too, almost triumphantly. By Jove, it was positively a mercy that he died when he did. It was indeed. Everyone said so at the time."
The prince was beside himself. "Pavlicheff? Pavlicheff turned Roman Catholic? Impossible!" he cried in horror.
"Impossible is rather a strong word," said Ivan Petrovitch. "You must allow, my dear prince. However, of course you value the memory of the deceased so very highly, and he certainly was the kindest of men, to which fact, by the way, I ascribe, more than to anything else, the success of the abbot in influencing his religious convictions. But you may ask me, if you please, how much trouble and worry I, personally, had over that business, and especially with this same Gurot. Would you believe it?" he continued, addressing the dignitary. "They actually tried to put in a claim under the deceased's will, and I had to resort to the very strongest measures in order to bring them to their senses. I assure you they knew their cue, did these gentlemen. Wonderful! Thank goodness all this was in Moscow, and I got the court, you know, to help me, and we soon brought them to their senses."
"You wouldn't believe how you have pained and astonished me," cried the prince.
"Very sorry. But in point of fact, you know, it was all nonsense and would have ended in smoke, as usual, I'm sure of that. Last year," he turned to the old man again, "Countess K. joined some Roman convent abroad. Our people never seem to be able to offer any resistance so soon as they get into the hands of these intriguers, especially abroad." "That is all thanks to our lassitude, I think," replied the old man with authority. "And then their way of preaching. They have a skilful manner of doing it, and they know how to startle one, too. I got quite a fright myself in 32 in Vienna, I assure you, but I didn't cave into them. I ran away instead. Ha ha! Come, come, I've always heard that you ran away with the beautiful Countess Levitsky that time, throwing up everything in order to do it, and not from the Jesuits at all," said Princess Bielokonski suddenly. "Well, yes, but we call it from the Jesuits, you know. It comes to the same thing," laughed the old fellow, delighted with the pleasant recollection. "You seem to be very religious," he continued kindly, addressing the prince, which is a thing one meets so seldom nowadays among young people."
The prince was listening open-mouthed, and still in a condition of excited agitation. The old man was evidently interested in him, and anxious to study him more closely. "Pavlicheff was a man of bright intellect and a good Christian, a sincere Christian," said the prince, suddenly. "How could he possibly embrace a faith which is unchristian? Roman Catholicism is, so to speak, simply the same thing as unchristianity," he added with flashing eyes, which seemed to take in everybody in the room.
"Come, that's a little too strong, isn't it?"
murmured the old man, glancing at General Epanchin in surprise.
"How do you make out that the Roman Catholic religion is unchristian? What is it, then?" asked Ivan Petrovitch, turning to the prince.
"It is not a Christian religion, in the first place," said the latter, in extreme agitation, quite out of proportion to the necessity of the moment. "And in the second place, Roman Catholicism is, in my opinion, worse than atheism itself. Yes, that is my opinion. Atheism only preaches a negation, but Romanism goes further. It preaches a disfigured, distorted Christ. It preaches Antichrist. I assure you, I swear it. This is my own personal conviction, and it has long distressed me. The Roman Catholic believes that the Church on earth cannot stand without universal temporal power. He cries non possumus. In my opinion, the Roman Catholic religion is not a faith at all, but simply a continuation of the Roman Empire, and everything is subordinated to this idea, beginning with faith. The Pope has seized territories and an earthly throne, and has held them with the sword. And so the thing has gone on, only that to the sword they have added lying, intrigue, deceit, fanaticism, superstition, swindling. They have played fast and loose with the most sacred and sincere feelings of men. They have exchanged everything, everything for money, for base earthly power. And is this not the teaching of Antichrist? How could the upshot of all this be other than atheism? Atheism is the child of Roman Catholicism. It proceeded from these Romans themselves, though perhaps they would not believe it. It grew and fattened on hatred of its parents. It is the progeny of their lies and spiritual feebleness. Atheism! In our country, it is only among the upper classes that you find unbelievers, men who have lost the root or spirit of their faith. But abroad, whole masses of the people are beginning to profess unbelief, at first because of the darkness and lies by which they were surrounded, but now out of fanaticism, out of loathing for the Church and Christianity. The prince paused to get breath. He had spoken with extraordinary rapidity and was very pale. All present interchanged glances, but at last the old dignitary burst out laughing frankly. Prince N. took out his eyeglass to have a good look at the speaker. The German poet came out of his corner and crept nearer to the table with a spiteful smile.
"You exaggerate the matter very much," said Ivan Petrovitch, with rather a bored air. "There are, in the foreign churches, many representatives of their faith who are worthy of respect and esteem."
"Oh, but I did not speak of individual representatives. I was merely talking about Roman Catholicism and its essence, of Rome itself. A church can never entirely disappear. I never hinted at that."
"Agreed that all this may be true, but we need not discuss a subject which belongs to the domain of theology."
Oh, no. Not to theology alone, I assure you. Why, socialism is the progeny of Romanism and of the Romanistic spirit. It and its brother atheism proceed from despair in opposition to Catholicism. It seeks to replace in itself the moral power of religion, in order to appease the spiritual thirst of parched humanity and save it, not by Christ, but by force. Don't dare to believe in God. Don't dare to possess any individuality, any property. Fraternite ou la mort, 2 million heads. By their works ye shall know them, we are told, and we must not suppose that all this is harmless and without danger to ourselves. Oh, no, we must resist, and quickly. We must let our Christ shine forth upon the Western nations, our Christ whom we have preserved intact, and whom they have never known. Not as slaves, allowing ourselves to be caught by the hooks of the Jesuits, but carrying our Russian civilization to them. We must stand before them, not letting it be said among us that their preaching is skillful, as someone expressed it just now.
But excuse me, excuse me!"
cried Ivan Petrovitch, considerably disturbed, and looking around uneasily.
"Your ideas are, of course, most praiseworthy, and in the highest degree patriotic, but you exaggerate the matter terribly. It would be better if we dropped the subject."
"No, sir, I do not exaggerate. I understate the matter, if anything, undoubtedly understate it, simply because I cannot express myself as I should like, but—"
"Allow me."
The prince was silent. He sat straight up in his chair and gazed fervently at Ivan Petrovitch.
"It seems to me that you have been too painfully impressed by the news of what happened to your good benefactor," said the old dignitary kindly, and with the utmost calmness of demeanour. "You are excitable, perhaps as the result of your solitary life. If you would make up your mind to live more among your fellows in society, I trust, I am sure, that the world would be glad to welcome you as a remarkable young man, and you would soon find yourself able to look at things more calmly. You would see that all these things are much simpler than you think. And besides, these rare cases come about, in my opinion, from ennui and from satiety."
"Exactly, exactly! That is a true thought," cried the prince. "From ennui, from our ennui, but not from satiety. Oh, no, you are wrong there. Say from thirst, if you like, the thirst of fever. And please do not suppose that this is so small a matter that we may have a laugh at it and dismiss it. We must be able to foresee our disasters and arm against them. We Russians no sooner arrive at the brink of the water and realize that we are really at the brink than we are so delighted with the outlook that in we plunge and swim to the farthest point we can see. Why is this? You say you are surprised at Pavlicheff's action. You ascribe it to madness, to kindness of heart, and what not, but it is not so. Our Russian intensity not only astonishes ourselves, all Europe wonders at our conduct in such cases. For, if one of us goes over to Roman Catholicism, he is sure to become a Jesuit at once, and a rabid one into the bargain. If one of us becomes an atheist, he must needs begin to insist on the prohibition of faith in God by force, that is, by the sword. Why is this? Why does he then exceed all bounds at once? Because he has found land at last, the fatherland that he sought in vain before. And because his soul is rejoiced to find it, he throws himself upon it and kisses it. Oh, it is not from vanity alone. It is not from feelings of vanity that Russians become atheists and Jesuits, but from spiritual thirst, from anguish of longing for higher things, for dry, firm land, for foothold on a fatherland, which they never believed in, because they never knew it. It is easier for a Russian to become an atheist than for any other nationality in the world. And not only does a Russian become an atheist, but he actually believes in atheism, just as though he had found a new faith, not perceiving that he has pinned his faith to a negation. Such is our anguish of thirst. Whoso has no country has no God. That is not my own expression. It is the expression of a merchant, one of the old believers, whom I once met while travelling. He did not say exactly these words. I think his expression was, 'Whoso forsakes his country forsakes his God.' But let these thirsty Russian souls find, like Columbus' discoverers, a new world. Let them find the Russian world. Let them search and discover all the gold and treasure that lies hid in the bosom of their own land. Show them the restitution of lost humanity in the future, by Russian thought alone, and by means of the God and of the Christ of our Russian faith, and you will see how mighty and just and wise and good a giant will rise up before the eyes of the astonished and frightened world, astonished because they expect nothing but the sword from us, because they think they will get nothing out of us but barbarism. This has been the case up to now, and the longer matters go on as they are now proceeding, the more clear will be the truth of what I say, and I—"
But at this moment something happened which put a most unexpected end to the orator's speech. All this heated tirade, this outflow of passionate words and ecstatic ideas which seemed to hustle and tumble over each other as they fell from his lips, bore evidence of some unusually disturbed mental condition in the young fellow who had boiled over in such a remarkable manner, without any apparent reason. Of those who were present, such as knew the prince listened to his outburst in a state of alarm, some with a feeling of mortification. It was so unlike his usual timid self-constraint, so inconsistent with his usual taste and tact, and with his instinctive feeling for the higher proprieties. They could not understand the origin of the outburst. It could not be simply the news of Pavlicheff's perversion. By the ladies the prince was regarded as little better than a lunatic, and Princess Bielokonski admitted afterwards that in another minute she would have bolted. The two old gentlemen looked quite alarmed. The old general, Epanchin's chief, sat and glared at the prince in severe displeasure. The colonel sat immovable. Even the German poet grew a little pale, though he wore his usual artificial smile as he looked around to see what the others would do. In point of fact, it is quite possible that the matter would have ended in a very commonplace and natural way in a few minutes. The undoubtedly astonished, but now more collected, General Epanchin had several times endeavoured to interrupt the prince, and not having succeeded, he was now preparing to take firmer and more vigorous measures to attain his end. In another minute or two he would probably have made up his mind to lead the prince quietly out of the room, on the plea of his being ill, and it was more than likely that the general was right in his belief that the prince was actually ill. But it so happened that destiny had something different in store. At the beginning of the evening, when the prince first came into the room, he had sat down as far as possible from the Chinese vase which Aglaya had spoken of the day before. Will it be believed that, after Aglaya's alarming words, an ineradicable conviction had taken possession of his mind that, however he might try to avoid this vase next day, he must certainly break it? But so it was. During the evening other impressions began to awaken in his mind, as we have seen, and he forgot his presentiment. But when Pavlicheff was mentioned and the general introduced him to Ivan Petrovitch, he had changed his place and went over nearer to the table. When, it so happened, he took the chair nearest to the beautiful vase, which stood on a pedestal behind him, just about on a level with his elbow. As he spoke his last words he had risen suddenly from his seat with a wave of his arm, and there was a general cry of horror. The huge vase swayed backwards and forwards. It seemed to be uncertain whether or no to topple over onto the head of one of the old men, but eventually determined to go the other way, and came crashing over towards the German poet, who darted out of the way in terror. The crash, the cry, the sight of the fragments of valuable china covering the carpet, the alarm of the company. What all this meant to the poor prince it would be difficult to convey to the mind of the reader, or for him to imagine. But one very curious fact was that all the shame and vexation and mortification which he felt over the accident were less powerful than the deep impression of the almost supernatural truth of his premonition. He stood still in alarm, in almost superstitious alarm, for a moment. Then all mists seemed to clear away from his eyes. He was conscious of nothing but light and joy and ecstasy. His breath came and went, but the moment passed. Thank God it was not that! He drew a long breath and looked around. For some minutes he did not seem to comprehend the excitement around him. That is, he comprehended it and saw everything, but he stood aside, as it were, like someone invisible in a fairy tale, as though he had nothing to do with what was going on, though it pleased him to take an interest in it. He saw them gather up the broken bits of china. He heard the loud talking of the guests and observed how pale Aglaya looked, and how very strangely she was gazing at him. There was no hatred in her expression, and no anger whatever. It was full of alarm for him, and sympathy and affection, while she looked around at the others with flashing, angry eyes. His heart filled with a sweet pain as he gazed at her. At length he observed, to his amazement, that all had taken their seats again, and were laughing and talking as though nothing had happened. Another minute, and the laughter grew louder. They were laughing at him, at his dumb stupor, laughing kindly and merrily. Several of them spoke to him, and spoke so kindly and cordially, especially Lizabetha Prokofievna. She was saying the kindest possible things to him. Suddenly he became aware that General Epanchin was tapping him on the shoulder. Ivan Petrovitch was laughing too, but still more kind and sympathizing was the old dignitary. He took the prince by the hand and pressed it warmly. Then he patted it, and quietly urged him to recollect himself, speaking to him exactly as he would have spoken to a little frightened child, which pleased the prince wonderfully, and next seated him beside himself. The prince gazed into his face with pleasure, but still seemed to have no power to speak. His breath failed him. The old man's face pleased him greatly. "Do you really forgive me?" he said at last. And Lizabetha Prokofievna, too?" The laugh increased. Tears came into the prince's eyes. He could not believe in all this kindness. He was enchanted.
"The vase certainly was a very beautiful one. I remember it here for 15 years. Yes, quite that," remarked Ivan Petrovitch.
"Oh, what a dreadful calamity! A wretched vase smashed, and a man half dead with remorse about it," said Lizabetha Prokofievna, loudly. "What made you so dreadfully startled, Lef Nikolaevitch?" she added, a little timidly. "Come, my dear boy, cheer up. You really alarm me, taking the accident so to heart."
"Do you forgive me all, besides the vase, I mean?" said the prince, rising from his seat once more, but the old gentleman caught his hand and drew him down again. He seemed unwilling to let him go.
"Cetre curux et cetre serux," he whispered across the table to Ivan Petrovitch, rather loudly. Probably the prince heard him.
"So that I have not offended any of you? You will not believe how happy I am to be able to think so. It is as it should be. As if I could offend anyone here. I should offend you again by even suggesting such a thing."
"Calm yourself, my dear fellow. You are exaggerating again. You really have no occasion to be so grateful to us. It is a feeling which does you great credit, but an exaggeration for all that."
"I am not exactly thanking you. I am only feeling a growing admiration for you. It makes me happy to look at you. I dare say I am speaking very foolishly, but I must speak. I must explain, if it be out of nothing better than self-respect."
All he said and did was abrupt, confused, feverish. Very likely the words he spoke, as often as not, were not those he wished to say. He seemed to inquire whether he might speak. His eyes lighted on Princess Bielokonski.
"All right, my friend, talk away, talk away," she remarked. "Only don't lose your breath. You were in such a hurry when you began, and look what you've come to now. Don't be afraid of speaking. All these ladies and gentlemen have seen far stranger people than yourself. You don't astonish them. You are nothing out of the way remarkable, you know. You've done nothing but break a vase and give us all a fright."
The prince listened, smiling. "Wasn't it you," he said, suddenly turning to the old gentleman, "who saved the student Prokhanov and a clerk named Shobron from being sent to Siberia 2 or 3 months since?" The old dignitary blushed a little and murmured that the prince had better not excite himself further.
"And I have heard of you," continued the prince, addressing Ivan Petrovitch, "that when some of your villagers were burned out, you gave them wood to build up their houses again, though they were no longer your serfs and had behaved badly towards you."
"Oh, come, come, you are exaggerating," said Ivan Petrovitch, beaming with satisfaction all the same. He was right, however, in this instance, for the report had reached the prince's ears in an incorrect form.
"And you, princess," he went on, addressing Princess Bielokonski, "was it not you who received me in Moscow 6 months since, as kindly as though I had been your own son, in response to a letter from Lizabetha Prokofievna, and gave me one piece of advice, again as to your own son, which I shall never forget? Do you remember?"
"What are you making such a fuss about?" said the old lady with annoyance. "You are a good fellow, but very silly. One gives you a halfpenny, and you are as grateful as though one had saved your life. You think this is praiseworthy on your part, but it is not. It is not, indeed."
She seemed to be very angry, but suddenly burst out laughing, quite good-humouredly. Lizabetha Prokofievna's face brightened up too. So did that of General Epanchin.
"I told you Lef Nikolaevitch was a man, if only he would not be in such a hurry as the princess remarked," said the latter with delight.
Aglaya alone seemed sad and depressed. Her face was flushed, perhaps with indignation.
"He really is very charming," whispered the old dignitary to Ivan Petrovitch.
"I came into this room with anguish in my heart," continued the prince with ever-growing agitation, speaking quicker and quicker, and with increasing strangeness. I was afraid of you all, and afraid of myself. I was most afraid of myself. When I returned to Petersburg, I promised myself to make a point of seeing our greatest men, and members of our oldest families, the old families like my own. I am now among princes like myself, am I not? I wished to know you, and it was necessary,
very, very necessary. I had always heard so much that was evil said of you all, more evil than good, as to how small and petty were your interests, how absurd your habits, how shallow your education, and so on. There is so much written and said about you. I came here today with anxious curiosity. I wished to see for myself, and form my own convictions, as to whether it were true that the whole of this upper stratum of Russian society is worthless, has outlived its time, has existed too long, and is only fit to die, and yet is dying with petty, spiteful warring against that which is destined to supersede it and take its place, hindering the coming men, and knowing not that itself is in a dying condition. I did not fully believe in this view even before, for there never was such a class among us, excepting perhaps at court by accident, or by uniform, but now there is not even that, is there? It has vanished, has it not?
No, not a bit of it, said Ivan Petrovitch, with a sarcastic laugh. Good Lord, he's off again, said Princess Bielokonski impatiently.
Laissez-le dire. He is trembling all over, said the old man in a warning whisper.
The prince certainly was beside himself. Well, what have I seen? He continued. I have seen men of graceful simplicity of intellect. I have seen an old man who is not above speaking kindly, and even listening to a boy like myself. I see before me persons who can understand, who can forgive, kind, good Russian hearts, hearts almost as kind and cordial as I met abroad. Imagine how delighted I must have been, and how surprised. Oh, let me express this feeling. I have so often heard, and I have even believed, that in society there was nothing but empty forms, and that reality had vanished, but I now see for myself that this can never be the case here, among us. It may be the order elsewhere, but not in Russia. Surely you are not all Jesuits and deceivers. I heard Prince N.'s story just now. Was it not simple-minded, spontaneous humour? Could such words come from the lips of a man who is dead, a man whose heart and talents are dried up? Could dead men and women have treated me so kindly as you have all been treating me today? Is there not material for the future in all this, for hope? Can such people fail to understand? Can such men fall away from reality?
Once more, let us beg you to be calm, my dear boy. We'll talk of all this another time. I shall do so with the greatest pleasure, for one, said the old dignitary with a smile. Ivan Petrovitch grunted and twisted round in his chair. General Epanchin moved nervously. The latter's chief had started a conversation with the wife of the dignitary, and took no notice whatever of the prince. But the old lady very often glanced at him, and listened to what he was saying.
"No, I had better speak," continued the prince, with a new outburst of feverish emotion, and turning towards the old man with an air of confidential trustfulness. "Yesterday Aglaya Ivanovna forbade me to talk, and even specified the particular subjects I must not touch upon. She knows well enough that I am odd when I get upon these matters. I am nearly 27 years old, and yet I know I am little better than a child. I have no right to express my ideas, and said so long ago. Only in Moscow, with Rogojin, did I ever speak absolutely freely. He and I read Pushkin together, all his works. Rogojin knew nothing of Pushkin, had not even heard his name. I am always afraid of spoiling a great thought or idea by my absurd manner. I have no eloquence, I know. I always make the wrong gestures, inappropriate gestures, and therefore I degrade the thought, and raise a laugh instead of doing my subject justice. I have no sense of proportion either, and that is the chief thing. I know it would be much better if I were always to sit still and say nothing. When I do so, I appear to be quite a sensible sort of person, and what's more, I think about things. But now I must speak. It is better that I should. I began to speak because you looked so kindly at me. You have such a beautiful face. I promised Aglaya Ivanovna yesterday that I would not speak all the evening.
Really? Said the old man, smiling.
But, at times, I can't help thinking that I am wrong in feeling so about it, you know. Sincerity is more important than elocution, isn't it?
Sometimes.
I want to explain all to you, everything, everything. I know you think me utopian, don't you? An idealist? Oh, no, I'm not, indeed. My ideas are all so simple. You don't believe me? You are smiling. Do you know I am sometimes very wicked, for I lose my faith?
This evening, as I came here, I thought to myself, what shall I talk about? How am I to begin so that they may be able to understand partially, at all events? How afraid I was, dreadfully afraid! And yet how could I be afraid? Was it not shameful of me? Was I afraid of finding a bottomless abyss of empty selfishness? Ah, that's why I'm so happy at this moment, because I find there is no bottomless abyss at all, but good, healthy material, full of life. It is not such a very dreadful circumstance that we are odd people, is it? For we really are odd, you know, careless, reckless, easily wearied of anything. We don't look thoroughly into matters, don't care to understand things. We are all like this, you and I, and all of them. Why, here are you, now. You are not a bit angry with me for calling you odd, are you? And if so, surely there is good material in you? Do you know, I sometimes think it is a good thing to be odd. We can forgive one another more easily and be more humble. No one can begin by being perfect. There is much one cannot understand in life at first. In order to attain to perfection, one must begin by failing to understand much. And if we take in knowledge too quickly, we very likely are not taking it in at all. I say all this to you, you who by this time understand so much, and doubtless have failed to understand so much also. I am not afraid of you any longer. You are not angry that a mere boy should say such words to you, are you? Of course not. You know how to forget and to forgive. You are laughing, Ivan Petrovitch? You think I am a champion of other classes of people? That I am their advocate? A democrat and an orator of equality? The prince laughed hysterically. He had several times burst into these little, short, nervous laughs. Oh, no, it is for you, for myself, and for all of us together that I am alarmed. I am a prince of an old family myself, and I am sitting among my peers, and I am talking like this in the hope of saving us all, in the hope that our class will not disappear altogether, into the darkness, unguessing its danger, blaming everything around it, and losing ground every day. Why should we disappear and give place to others, when we may still, if we choose, remain in the front rank and lead the battle? Let us be servants, that we may become lords in due season. He tried to get upon his feet again, but the old man still restrained him, gazing at him with increasing perturbation as he went on. Listen, I know it is best not to speak. It is best simply to give a good example, simply to begin the work. I have done this. I have begun, and, oh, can anyone be unhappy, really? Oh, what does grief matter? What does misfortune matter, if one knows how to be happy? Do you know, I cannot understand how anyone can pass by a green tree and not feel happy, only to look at it. How anyone can talk to a man and not feel happy in loving him. Oh, it is my own fault that I cannot express myself well enough. But there are lovely things at every step I take, things which even the most miserable man must recognize as beautiful. Look at a little child, look at God's day dawn, look at the grass growing, look at the eyes that love you as they gaze back into your eyes. He had risen and was speaking standing up. The old gentleman was looking at him now in unconcealed alarm. Lizabetha Prokofievna wrung her hands. Oh, my God! She cried. She had guessed the state of the case before anyone else. Aglaya rushed quickly up to him, and was just in time to receive him in her arms, and to hear with dread and horror that awful, wild cry as he fell writhing to the ground. There he lay on the carpet, and someone quickly placed a cushion under his head. No one had expected this. In a quarter of an hour or so, Prince N. and Evgeny Pavlovitch and the old dignitary were hard at work, endeavouring to restore the harmony of the evening, but it was of no avail, and very soon after the guests separated and went their ways. A great deal of sympathy was expressed. A considerable amount of advice was volunteered. Ivan Petrovitch expressed his opinion that the young man was a Slavophile or something of that sort, but that it was not a dangerous development. The old dignitary said nothing. True enough, most of the guests, next day and the day after, were not in very good humour. Ivan Petrovitch was a little offended, but not seriously so. General Epanchin's chief was rather cool towards him for some while after the occurrence. The old dignitary, as patron of the family, took the opportunity of murmuring some kind of admonition to the general, and added, in flattering terms, that he was most interested in Aglaya's future. He was a man who really did possess a kind heart, although his interest in the prince, in the earlier part of the evening, was due, among other reasons, to the latter's connection with Nastasia Philipovna, according to popular report. He had heard a good deal of this story here and there, and was greatly interested in it, so much so that he longed to ask further questions about it. Princess Bielokonski, as she drove away on this eventful evening, took occasion to say to Lizabetha Prokofievna,
"Well, he's a good match, and a bad one, and if you want my opinion, more bad than good. You can see for yourself the man is an invalid."
Lizabetha therefore decided that the prince was impossible as a husband for Aglaya, and during the ensuing night she made a vow that never while she lived should he marry Aglaya. With this resolve firmly impressed upon her mind, she awoke next day, but during the morning, after her early lunch, she fell into a condition of remarkable inconsistency. In reply to a very guarded question of her sister's, Aglaya had answered coldly, but exceedingly haughtily, "I have never given him my word at all, nor have I ever counted him as my future husband, never in my life. He is just as little to me as all the rest." Lizabetha Prokofievna suddenly flared up.
"I did not expect that of you, Aglaya," she said. "He is an impossible husband for you, I know it, and thank God that we agree upon that point. But I did not expect to hear such words from you. I thought I should hear a very different tone from you. I would have turned out everyone who was in the room last night and kept him. That's the sort of man he is, in my opinion."
Here she suddenly paused, afraid of what she had just said, but she little knew how unfair she was to her daughter at that moment. It was all settled in Aglaya's mind. She was only waiting for the hour that would bring the matter to a final climax, and every hint, every careless probing of her wound, did but further lacerate her heart. End of chapter 7.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.